1230 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. The last of former President Trump's co-defendants charged in a racketeering scheme to overturn Georgia's 2020 election results have surrendered, says CBS's Scott McFarland.
All 19 co-defendants in the sweeping racketeering case in Fulton County have now surrendered for booking, including the former president.
What has taken place here is a travesty of justice.
His campaign has already begun selling merchandise with Trump's booking photo. President Biden commented on the picture Friday.
Have you seen Donald Trump's mugshot yet? Mr. President, are you worried at all about that?
I did see it on television.
What'd you think?
Handsome guy.
Cool conditions with lower humidity today for the northern plains to the Midwest and interior northeast, says Weather Channel meteorologist Kelly Cass on CBS Saturday mornings.
We've got heat advisories, excessive heat warnings still in effect, and you'll notice these temperatures going well up into the triple digits. Tack on the humidity, it will feel even worse. However, there is some relief on the way, courtesy of a cold front, a dip in the jet stream that will bring showers and storms throughout the weekend, but also cooler temperatures and, more importantly, lower humidity.
But the biggest wildfire in Louisiana history continues to burn, along with hundreds of others along the Gulf Coast, forcing evacuations. CBS's Nicole Skanga.
A mandatory evacuation was ordered for several nearby towns.
There was smoke right behind my house. And this helicopter come with this big old bucket full of water.
NASA and SpaceX this morning launched a crew of four astronauts, all from different countries, to the International Space Station. CBS News space consultant Bill Harwood.
The Crew 7 spacecraft is carrying an American commander, a female commander actually, a Danish co-pilot, a Japanese surgeon astronaut, and a Russian cosmonaut. It's the most international SpaceX Crew Dragon flight yet launched. It reflects the nature of the International Space Station when you have a crew like this.
The head of Spain's Soccer Federation still is defiantly refusing to resign, says CBS's Mara Rubin.
Spain's women's soccer team say they will not play another match until Spanish football president Luis Rubiales resigns, which he refuses to do. He claims the kiss after the Women's World Cup final was consensual and says he's the victim of a witch hunt led by false feminists. He added, the kiss was the same I could give one of my daughters.
A wealthy county is giving some families money for 15 months with no restrictions on how it can be spent. Fairfax County in Northern Virginia is giving 180 families $750 a month with financial coaching. This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Reports on electric vehicle sales are mixed. Mike Mohn spoke with analysts who say electric vehicle sales trends are encouraging.
Wisconsin has lagged behind other states in electric vehicle registrations, with data showing it ranks 35th in the nation. But the Wisconsin Policy Forum notes that registrations have increased on average by nearly 52% each year over the past decade. As for reports of high inventories, Chris Hardo of Consumer Reports says the estimates exclude EV-only dealers and that their inventories are well below the industry average. Hardo acknowledges that higher interest rates might eventually put a dent in sales of all vehicles, but he says it hasn't happened yet. Customers are still snatching up cars that were hard to find when the pandemic was crippling supply chains. And he says the public remains intrigued by the EV market.
Our surveys to date have showed a pretty significant chunk of the American car buying public who are interested in buying electric vehicle are curious about buying electric vehicle.
It's just an open question of when a lot of these consumers will take the plunge as more EV models come on board. Hardo's analysis finds that 70% of EV sales this year are from just 9 models, all of which have a starting price under $45,000 when factoring in incentives. That's below the average new vehicle price. He suggests those models can be competitive sales-wise, as opposed to higher-priced luxury EVs. Mike Moen, Wisconsin News Connection. Find our rate trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And this is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
The kids are heading back to class, but when the subject is school, we have to talk about the first kindergarten started in Wisconsin. Marguerite Schurz created what is known as America's First Kindergarten in 1856, teaching a small class at her family's home in Watertown. It's about 50 miles west-northwest of Milwaukee. So can you guess, when did kindergarten become part of the state's public school system? The answer coming up. Schurz learned about kindergarten in Germany, where the idea was common. It wasn't in America, and her class grew so quickly, she had to move to a bigger space. Today, the building remains as a Watertown museum. So did you guess when kindergarten became part of the public school system in the state? It was 1898, but 42 years prior, the Schurz School started it all, making this a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, August 26, 2023. Thank you so much for joining me this morning on Morning Cannolis. 2 hours of our weekly review, our analysis, our discussion of those most important news events, those great stories in law, in government, and yes, the aspiration for justice in America. As always, we're coming to you this morning from the studios of Civic Media in downtown Waukesha, but we are broadcasting throughout this great state of Wisconsin. Welcome to our discussion this morning. As always, I'm joined in my studio by my wonderful producer, and her name is Anya. Together, we're taking your phone calls at 844-967-2789. That telephone number once again, 844-967-2789. Also, you can text me and Anya through the Civic Media app. Get on the app, take a look at our show, identify the radio station through which you hear this broadcast, and be a part of our discussion this morning. As always, we have an ambitious but achievable agenda. An extensive but important syllabus this morning. I'm going to talk with you about that in just a moment or so. And we always ask three important questions. What do we know? What do we know about the facts of what has happened in this past week, this past month, sometimes even in the past year? Why are those things important? Why are they significant? Why are they relevant to the times in which we live? And what should we do about those things? What actions, what responses should we undertake in response to those things that are happening in our lives? As always, we're going to be asking and hopefully answering some, if not all, of those questions this morning. Once again, thank you so much for joining me this morning on Morning Cannolis. Let me tell you a bit about our ambitious but, again, achievable syllabus. We have not had a segment recently called Undiscovered Justice, and we're going to start that this morning. We're going to talk about two places in America, one of them, of course, right here in Wisconsin, but also in Minnesota, the state of Minnesota. We're going to go overseas to talk about something significant that happened this past week in Germany, both of them related to some stories in the area of undiscovered justice on the face of this planet, locally and beyond. And then, of course, we're going to be doing some rule of law snapshots, everything coming out of the news of just this past week in places like Georgia and Washington, D.C., and other spots throughout our nation. And then we're going to return to our continuing review of these major allegations made against the former president, Donald Trump, principally, although not exclusively, in this major indictment coming out of a grand jury in the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia. We have been spending the last couple of broadcasts talking in great detail, even reciting to some extent, the nature and the content and the focus of many of those allegations, the four principal counts against the former president pending in the federal case. Again, this different from the case pending out of Fulton County in Georgia, which we will also talk about this morning. I'm going to go back and review some of those in the interest of giving some meat to the bones when it comes to what those indictments are all about. I think it's important, as I've said before, for people to understand that these are not simply allegations of broad criminal charges. They are that. But they're also animated by specific conversations and contacts and events that are described with great particularity in these indictments. And I think it's informative, regardless of how you come down. We always understand that every defendant, including the former president, is presumed innocent until established, until it is shown to a jury, a unanimous jury, beyond a reasonable doubt, that there is guilt attaching to one or more of these counts. But it is important, even along the way, to understand what the nature of those allegations are. It's not simply lawyers. It's not simply grand jurors talking about broad statutes. It is about things that happened in our recent national history. And I think it is significant that all of us take some inventory of what those conversations, what those actions, those events were, so that when we speak about the extent to which these indictments are important, and they are, not only presently, but also to the future of America, we've got some understanding of what animates them. What's the basis for them? What's the predicate for going forward, even in your own discussions among people with whom you agree, among people with whom you do not agree, to be able to talk about some of this. And so we're doing that again this second hour of our broadcast this morning, encouraging you once again to join Anya and me for that discussion. Phone number once again, 844-967-2789. Undiscovered justice. Some things outside of these recent focuses that we have had on the complaints and the indictments against the former president and many others involving January 6th, involving the Mar-a-Lago documents matter, involving an attempt to undermine justice in Manhattan, perhaps other places, both civilly and criminally there. We're going to talk this morning about two other instances out there unrelated to those events that underscore the significance of what can in fact happen in the area of justice, the importance of rule of law, promoting it in our nation, in our state, and throughout the face of the planet, across the face of the planet. We're going to begin initially by talking about Germany. And in Germany in particular, some major news having to do with the immigration laws in that country. Let's back into it this way. We know from our recent history that our own United States Congress, our government, our federal government generally, which is charged by the Constitution, the exclusive ambit, the exclusive area for its focus in the immigration area is federal. It is not a state matter, contrary to what some governors in the southern border may say. The matters related to immigration, not only border patrol and border enforcement, but also pathways to citizenship. All of those things that we talk about when we consider immigration in America, all of those are federal in nature. They're committed exclusively by our Constitution to the actions and the undertakings of our Congress, by our executive branch, and yes, as we've also learned, through our judicial branch as well, as they determine whether or not the actions of our legislature and our president are constitutional or not. And we have been frustrated in America by the fact that for many, many decades, we have not had the omnibus, the comprehensive kind of immigration reform that will address everything from border enforcement, which again continues to be both politically and socially a major issue in our nation, needs to be addressed in some way that ensures that people seeking asylum, seeking a passage into this nation through our southern and other borders, have a mechanism, a clear understanding of how the process works, and there is some order in a time when, unfortunately, we continue not to have order. And secondarily, for those immigrants who are here, legally, illegally, we've got a pathway forward. How do we handle their cases? We have not had a Congress in several decades that has been willing to wrestle dispositively, definitively with this issue. And so we continue to wander in this area of immigration in the United States of America without clarity. Germany, just this past week, is beginning to give us some way forward. What did Germany do to begin to address their own immigration issues as they go forward in addressing the things that they have on their docket? The German government, just this past week, the executive branch, if you will, presented a new citizenship law just this past Wednesday, the 23rd. And the legislation proposed by Interior Minister Nancy Faeser, F-A-E-S-E-R is her name, will make dual citizenship easier as well as naturalization for non-European Union citizens. Now, what's this all about? Well, she says, among other things, that this reform shows a commitment to a modern Germany. Again, invoking many of the things that we think about in terms of our own nation, the ways in which we should be contemporary and modern, and most importantly, human in addressing these uniquely human issues of immigration, people coming to the United States, in this case, coming to Germany. So what does the law say? What does this proposed new law envision in the nation of Germany, from which we can take perhaps some clues and some cues when it comes to the possibility of doing the same kinds of things? Not exactly. We've got different challenges. We've got different geographic circumstances, different population circumstances. But the notion here is that legislatures and governments can, in fact, act to address immigration issues. What does the German law say? Immigrants legally living in Germany will be allowed to apply for citizenship after 5 years rather than the current 8, reducing the number of years, collapsing, if you will, these long periods of time that we see here in the United States, collapsing that in Germany as well. If they have special achievements, that can go down to only 3 years, and those have to be defined, of course, legislatively and administered by their immigration authorities. But again, reducing the amount of time, which is a huge issue in Germany, but also here in our country, to administer and get these applications processed. Children born in Germany of at least one parent who's been living legally in the country for 5 or more years will automatically get German citizenship. Again, a different circumstance than what we have here, but we think about our own DACA young people now, not so young people anymore, but people looking for a way forward in this nation, brought here to our country at a time when they were very young. In Germany, children born in that nation of at least one parent who's been living in the country legally for 5 years automatically get German citizenship. Immigrants above the age of 67 will be able to do an oral instead of a written German language test. And multiple citizenships, as I indicated, will be allowed. People living entirely on state support will not be eligible for German citizenship. However, some other accommodations made along the way. And significantly, inside this important package coming out of Germany just this past week, German citizenship will be denied to people who have committed anti-Semitic, racist, xenophobic, or other defamatory offenses that are seen to be unreconcilable with commitment to the basic free democratic order established by the German population and the government there. A real fundamental notion that, again, you're not entitled to German citizenship. There's a process that will be streamlined. But if you are a part of a group, if you are espousing views that are contrary to what a democratic republic should be all about, you will not get citizenship there. Nonetheless, coming out of Germany this past week and this major announcement of new legislation going to be debated in the parliament this coming fall could take effect as soon as this fall, depending upon what the parliament does. Highly likely it will be passed there. What is the lesson for America? The lesson is simple. This can be done. This can be done, and we can do it in a bipartisan, non-political nature by coming together in a way that, yes, is practical. We don't all have to agree with every single aspect of the legislation. There are packages out there pending in Congress right now that could be the subject of meaningful review by committees on both the House side, the Senate side. All of that needs to happen. Let's follow the lesson of Germany and see if in America we can finally, across political aisles, on behalf of human beings here legally, here illegally, work on getting natural and important immigration issues addressed. When we come back, we'll do the other important matter related to undiscovered justice. It comes from the state of Minnesota. Stay with us right after this break for that discussion of more undiscovered justice here on Morning Cannolis.
The kids are heading back to class, but when the subject is school, we have to talk about the first kindergarten started in Wisconsin. Marguerite Schurz created what is known as America's First Kindergarten in 1856, teaching a small class at her family's home in Watertown. It's about 50 miles west-northwest of Milwaukee. So can you guess, when did kindergarten become part of the state's public school system? The answer coming up. Schurz learned about kindergarten in Germany, where the idea was common. It wasn't in America, and her class grew so quickly, she had to move to a bigger space. Today, the building remains as a Watertown museum. So did you guess when kindergarten became part of the public school system in the state? It was 1898. But 42 years prior, the Schurz School started it all, making this a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Direct from the Dairy State, it's Sharp Cheddar Weekends, a three-hour block of Wisconsin-produced radio, Saturdays and Sundays from 11 a.m. till 2 p.m., featuring Raised in Wisco with Joel Clayfish and Danielle Fairman, The Cripes Cast with Charlie Behrens, and Under the Helmet with the Gravedigger, Gilbert Brown. You can enjoy it by the slice or enjoy the whole darn thing. Sharp Cheddar Weekends is radio so fresh, it squeaks. Listen in on the Civic Media Station or on the app.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. Daytime highs approaching 71 this afternoon. Under overcast skies, northeasterly winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. Tonight, lows level off around 58. Highs around 73. Tomorrow, bright sunshine. Mainly clear skies Monday, with daytime highs approaching 78. 76, chance for scattered showers Tuesday. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 64 degrees.
Your home for the Devil's Advocates.
Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6.
On The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
Sun in the sky.
And we are back on Morning Cannolis this Saturday, August 26, 2023. Thank you once again for joining me for these 2 hours of discussion, beginning this morning with a couple of stories, positive stories about things that can, in fact, happen in our nation, in our state, in our world. Undiscovered justice, a couple of things related to immigration laws being passed in Germany that enhance and promote diversity there in that nation while also addressing matters related to the labor force and ensuring diversity in that area as well. Let's do one more story in the area of undiscovered justice, and that is in our neighboring state of Minnesota. Here's the headline on the story. People with felony convictions can now vote. In Minnesota, a new law passed not so long ago in the state of Minnesota allows people with felony convictions, again, these are state convictions in the state of Minnesota, to vote as long as they are not currently at the time incarcerated. Still did not include those folks who are still incarcerated. Expands voting rights in Minnesota, expanding the franchise to at least 55,000 people. Up to now have not been able to vote because of this impediment imposed by state law now stripped away. The Secretary of State there, a fellow named Steve Simon, said this is the largest single act of enfranchisement in over 50 years in our state. And he said that this is a Restore the Vote initiative, not only to establish that this right is out there, but also to move around the state and ensure that people who are, again, have recently been released from Minnesota prisons, who are no longer incarcerated, know about this right so that they can register under the state of Minnesota laws, that they can vote in future elections. And that's also a part of this initiative. There's a fellow named Antonio Williams, who's formerly incarcerated, and he's now a nonprofit director there in Minnesota. He spoke at the ceremony announcing all this. He said, after spending years of registering other people to vote, I will now be able to register myself. And indeed, many people in the state of Minnesota, again, approximately 55,000 people, now eligible to vote based upon the enfranchisement granted them by the legislature, signed by the governor. A Democratic representative, Cedric Frazier, of New Hope, Minnesota, championed all of this. He says, because what we know that you've got strong and enduring democracies when you ensure that the vote the vote, the franchise, the possibility of voting for your representatives in the state house, in the federal system as well, that encourages who we are as a nation. It will allow, he said, the voices of the people to be heard. And as a part of this, of course, we take some inventory of what else is out there. Turns out that there are 22 other states that do, in fact, restore voting rights when people with felony convictions leave prison. Again, not while you're in prison, but 22 other states, almost half of the states in our nation, do the same kind of thing. Minnesota now joining them. And that's according to the National Conference of State Legislatures. And that includes significantly North Dakota and Indiana and Utah, places that you may not otherwise think intuitively would have that kind of forward-looking law. The vote is a good thing, should be extended to people who, again, have paid their debt, as one often says, to society. They have lived up to the commitment to serve their time in prison imposed upon them by a state court judge, a federal court judge, and now they're free. And as a part of their rehabilitation, their reentry, as we say in law enforcement circles, into the community, their access to employment and education and healthcare and all those other things we think about when we think about citizenship and residency, whether it's in Minnesota or Wisconsin or the United States, now you have access not only to those things, but also the right to elect the people who are going to represent you in the state house and indeed in the federal government as well. Some places like Maine and Vermont and the District of Columbia, there in those states, people with felony convictions who can vote while they're still in prison, those three states, Maine, Vermont, and District of Columbia. So we've got a patchwork, if you will, of a number of different states out there that have these kinds of pieces of legislation, acts that have been passed by their legislatures, signed by their governors to ensure that the franchise is as broad as it is. On this broadcast, when we have chatted about the importance of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and attempts still pending in our federal Congress to restore the basic trappings of it, sections 4 and 5 that have this pre-clearance procedure for those jurisdictions that have had a history of discrimination in voting. Also, Section 2, this basic fundamental notion inside the Voting Rights Act, lots of things to do legislatively to ensure that the vote in America is as broad as it possibly can be. This event in Minnesota, an encouragement, undiscovered justice, because it's probably not at the top of the headlines in America this past week and even months and going forward beyond that to implement this in Minnesota, but an important movement once again in the insurance, the guarantee that people in our nation eligible to vote have the right to do so and are not disenfranchised by virtue of the past, but are permitted to do so as a part of their participation in citizenship in our great nation, in our great state. Undiscovered Justice in America, Morning Cannolis, Saturday, August 26, 2023. I promised that most of our time this morning would be spent chatting about, yes, the major news stories of this past week. Let me review some of those and then go back and talk in greater detail again about what happened, what we know, why these things are important. We're going to spend some time talking about these very significant, again, I would offer this tragic, tragic series of events we are now witnessing in America having to do with the need, the absolute necessity to prosecute people who attempted to undermine our republic, to stop the election from going forward in the way that people voted, and to substitute their own views about what should happen over and above the views of those people who did, in fact, vote in the majority. We're going to talk, number one, about what happened in Georgia this past week, including the surrenders of 19 defendants charged in that state indictment by the DA in Fulton County. We're going to talk beyond that about some significant events having to do with the Mar-a-Lago case. And yes, indeed, we're going to chat more about a matter having to do with the January 6th indictment coming out of Washington, D.C. And here's your teaser for the next segment as well. Some hearings coming up on Monday of great importance in at least two of those cases in the courts. More news coming up on Monday and more commentary coming up here on Morning Cannolis right after this break.
Of the pine. You know how I feel. Keeping Southeast Wisconsin informed, engaged, and entertained. This is The Shaw.
540 AM and 101.1 FM. WAUK.
CBS News Brief. The federal judge in the election interference case against former President Trump may set a trial date on Monday. Former public defender Lucius Outlaw.
For the defense, it dictates when you're going to do your investigation, which witnesses you're going to reach out to, when you're going to file motions, and generally prepare for trial.
It's a steamy weekend ahead for parts of the country, says the Weather Channel meteorologist Kelly Cass on CBS Saturday Mornings.
The heat, the humidity is still a problem, especially across the south into Louisiana, where we desperately need the rainfall. We have a very bad deficit in places like Lake Charles and New Orleans. Where we are going to be getting the rain is Florida, thanks to the tropics.
People in the town of Maryville in southwestern Louisiana have been ordered to evacuate because of a wildfire that officials say is the largest they've ever seen. Ed Bush of the Red Cross.
We're supposed to kind of catch a break. And between hurricanes and tornadoes and now fires and other things, it's endless.
CBS News Brief. I'm Christopher Cruz.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. A passenger was shot on a Milwaukee County bus yesterday. WISN 12 reports the shooting near Capitol and Sherman Boulevard did happen on the bus, with two people involved in the altercation. A 41-year-old man was taken to the hospital with a wound to the shoulder. The corporate word is shrink, but to you and me, it's called theft. Pete Schwaba has more about the Waukesha County wordplay.
When leaders at the Menominee Falls-based Kohl's Corporation updated investors this week about a reduction in margins, the department store chain attributed part of the decline to what they call shrink. Kohl's, along with other retailers, have been addressing theft-related concerns, implementing measures such as securing products and hiring more staff. Kohl's earnings beat expectations in the second quarter, but profits were down 53% compared to a year ago.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
Sandwiches are the original fast food. What could be easier than spreading a bit of mustard on Country Hearth's cracked wheat bread, then topping with smoked ham and cheddar, or maybe a peanut butter and strawberry jam on Kids' Choice Whole Grain White. So, on your way to the lake or park this summer, skip the drive-thru and pack a cooler with your favorite sandwiches instead. Country Hearth Breads, baking our best for you.
Kids are heading back to class, but when the subject is school, we have to talk about the first kindergarten started in Wisconsin. Marguerite Schurz created what is known as America's First Kindergarten in 1856, teaching a small class at her family's home in Watertown. It's about 50 miles west, northwest of Milwaukee. So can you guess, when did kindergarten become part of the state's public school system? The answer coming up. Schurz learned about kindergarten in Germany, where the idea was common. It wasn't in America, and her class grew so quickly, she had to move to a bigger space. Today, the building remains as a Watertown museum. So did you guess when kindergarten became part of the public school system in the state? It was 1898, but 42 years prior, the Schurz School started it all, making this a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network. Thank you for listening to your local Civic Media radio station on air. Now join us anytime by finding and following our Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram pages. You'll also find social media links for your favorite shows and hosts on our website, civicmedia.us.
We are back. Thank you once again for joining me this morning in our discussion about some of these major events of just this past week, including one coming out of Fulton County, Georgia. We know that as of yesterday, all of the 19 state defendants charged in the indictment, the state indictment brought by a grand jury there in Fulton County, all 19 defendants have surrendered. And yes, all 19 have been booked. You can go online these days and you can see the booking photos and other information about each one of those 19, including lots and lots of lawyers. Lots of lawyers reporting this past week to Fulton County to be processed by the sheriff there. Pictures taken, photographs, and beyond that, other processing that's a part of the routine procedure, the rule of law process there in Fulton County, and I would offer in every other major state, local, and federal jurisdiction in our United States of America. All of them now processed as a part of the first steps in bringing to justice these individuals who are charged, again, presumed innocent until proven guilty, charged in this multiple count indictment, 19 people altogether, including, of course, in addition to those lawyers, the former president of the United States of America, Donald John Trump. Each one of them also charged with a violation of the Georgia RICO Act, the Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act, along with many, many other things related to forgery and false statements, impersonating public officers, filing false documents, making false statements, all kinds of things, some of which we're going to talk about again today and in our future broadcasts as well. Among those people who have surrendered and now are a part of the process, they met the deadline for coming in on time, are two of those lawyers. Let's talk about them. Kenneth Chesbro and Sidney Powell, both of them, of course, a part of this scheme, allegedly under RICO, other allegations in the indictment against them and others for violating a Georgia state law. Again, this is not a federal case. That's different. That's pending in Washington, D.C., much parallel, and we'll talk about that in just a few moments. Both of them, again, now a part of the process. Ken Chesbro, one of the lawyers who played the central role in developing the idea of having Trump supporters pretend to be electors from states won by Joe Biden, in fact, including authoring and being the architect of something called the Wisconsin Memorandum. We're going to talk later on about how that concept of initially having them be conditional, if you will, ultimately trying to supplant actually the real live, the true and credible electors from the state of Wisconsin and throughout other states. Ken Chesbro, again, brought into the system as of just this past week, along with Sidney Powell. Sidney Powell also identified by name in this indictment. She's also a lawyer, also charged with the RICO Act, computer theft, computer trespass, invasion of privacy, conspiracy to defraud the state, conspiracy to commit election fraud. Now, why do I bring both of those two among the entire 19 up? Because of the procedure that they appropriately invoked this past week. Through their lawyers, they have requested under state law an expedited, speedy trial. Of course, every defendant in our nation, whether you're in the state system, in a federal system, has a right to a speedy trial. In this particular instance, under Georgia law, you can specially ask for that. And it means that the judge is pretty much compelled, in this case, to grant that request. And so, at least as to Chesbro, and probably as to Sidney Powell as well, very soon, the judge who's presiding over this matter, once again in Fulton County, one of the major figures the judge is in this entire matter. We'll talk about something else he did recently, also significant with respect to Donald Trump. He has established a trial date, at least for these two out of the 19, Chesbro and Powell, for October 23rd. October 23rd of, yes, that's right, this year, in just a few weeks. And so Fannie Willis has said, let's go. Let's try. She said, I am ready to try all 19. She has proposed, as we well know, a very expedited trial date. She wants to try all of them together. That probably will not happen. But she has indicated she will go ahead and she will present evidence of their crimes as soon as we can get into court, she says. And these two defendants have asked under state law for an expedited, a speedy trial. The judge has set that for October 23rd of this year, not next year, not 2025, not 2026, of this year. And so what are the consequences of that? Well, if indeed they go forward with this, they will be tried separate, presumably separate from the other 17 co-defendants charged in that indictment. Also significant to watch what happens here. here. They're plainly receiving now through their attorneys a huge amount of discovery, huge amount of discovery. The indictment, as we well know, as we talked about before, is sweeping. It's broad. It is colossal. It is huge in its breadth. And one of the things that their attorneys are going to be doing, of course, in providing vigorous and effective representation, which is not only their right, but a requirement, a fundamental notion behind our system of justice, that everyone in a felony position there gets representation that is vigorous and effective. Note that right now. We'll come back to that in just a moment or so. Every single one of those defendants is entitled to have vigorous representation, which means review of all the documents, all the material that the government provides as a part of what's called discovery in this matter. It may well be that Mr. Cheesbrough, Ms. Powell may look at all this and say, well, gee, we can't get ready in time, either individually or through their counsel. And maybe they will withdraw those requests. But right now, as of this Saturday, they're on schedule to go to trial. And this case recently returned in October. The others, we do not have a trial date yet. And again, it underscores the fact that among these 19, many, many things will happen. Some going to trial independent of others. Likely some of them may enter into plea agreements with the state that presumably would contemplate their agreeing to plead guilty to certain offense conduct, presumably in exchange for their testimony. All kinds of things can happen as this goes forward. My own sense that the final disposition of this case will not happen for many, many years, including final judgments reviewed by appeals courts, affirming presumably, again, convictions under the state law of Georgia. It is a compelling case, but it is broad and sweeping. As many others have noted, it's a lot to consume. We also know that the same judge who's granting that request for a speedy trial said something else with respect to another defendant earlier this week, and that defendant's name is Donald Trump. The judge this past week, just like Judge Chutkan did in the federal case pending in Washington, D.C., also imposed some restrictions upon Donald Trump especially. Why? Because we know about some of his conduct going out there, speaking about the legitimacy of prosecutions, attacking prosecutors, suggesting witnesses are lying, suggesting the entire system is rigged in some way. And so this past week, that same judge imposed upon Donald Trump some requirements of his behavior, said specifically limiting the former president's social media use in connection with his indictment, 13 counts against him and his allies, as we know, in this effort to overturn the 2020 election. Fulton County Superior Judge, his name is Scott McAfee, M-C-A-F-E-E, signed an order banning Donald Trump from contacting any of his co-defendants or witnesses in the case, except through their attorneys. Again, attorneys can do that. They're officers of the court, subject to rules and regulations. Donald Trump now told, don't you talk to any other defendants, witnesses. Don't be out there, likewise, intimidating any co-defendants or witnesses in the case, including, the judge said, on social media posts. Very similar to the kinds of things that Judge Chutkan said in the District of Columbia Court a couple of weeks ago. Judge in particular here in the Superior Court said the defendant, meaning Donald Trump, shall perform no act to intimidate any person known to him or her to be a co-defendant or witness in this case, or to otherwise obstruct the administration of justice. Judge went on to say the above shall include but are not limited to posts on social media or reposts of posts made by any other individual on social media. Sometimes referred to as a gag order. I'm not a big fan of that word because it suggests that your First Amendment rights are completely curtailed. They are not. This defendant, Donald Trump, are all of the other defendants in Georgia, any other defendants that might be charged in other jurisdictions, including the federal jurisdiction in Washington, D.C., they can be out there. They can talk about how they feel in their view of the evidence, their own positions that the case is against them is not strong. They can talk about how they look forward to their day in court, to their right to a trial by jury of their peers, to present their evidence. They can do those kinds of things and advocate on their behalf in the social media context and in other ways. What you can't do is you cannot say things that suggest that witnesses should not testify, that there are consequences, as this defendant already has done, to their doing so. You can't threaten them. You can't be out there, because not only is that in violation of the court rules, it is also a violation of the law. That's called obstruction of justice. And so once again, we've got a state court judge now just this past week who's saying, Mr. Trump, you better not do this, and setting down those rules. We will see. We will see. Just like the challenge before Judge Chutkan in the D.C. District Court, now we've got this challenge before Judge Scott McAfee to enforce that. And I suspect that both of them will, in ways big, small, known and unknown to us in this process. So we'll look forward to seeing that as well. So we've got all of the 19 surrendered. We've got these two going to trial. We've got a statement to Donald Trump that he is not to intimidate witnesses, not to have contact with co-defendants in this case, seeing whether or not he can live up to that particular obligation. And then we also have something else going on coming out of Georgia. Again, a part of our rule of law snapshots this morning. We've got five of these named defendants in the state indictment in Georgia seeking to remove this case, to transfer it from the state court to a federal district court in Georgia. Now, is there a process for doing that? The answer is yes. There is a federal statute that basically says that if you are a federal officer or a federal agent, and you are doing things in the scope of your duties and responsibilities, the things that you are charged to do, whether it's under the Constitution, under the statutes, by virtue of your oath of office, if you are exercising the duties and responsibilities of your office, things that we contemplate would be within the scope of your duties and responsibilities, not in your personal capacity, not in a political capacity, and certainly not criminal in nature. We don't send people to elected positions of office to engage in crimes and then permit them to use those actions as a way of getting around due process and all the other trappings of the rule of law. But if in fact you have done something and you are the subject of civil or criminal prosecution that implicates your actual practical exercise of your duties and responsibilities in that particular office, there's a mechanism for judges to look at that and say, well, gee, maybe that should be in federal court. Happens a lot in the civil context. Spent a lot of time when I was a civil chief, both here in eastern Wisconsin and also in western Michigan, making determinations about whether or not particular people, particular federal defendants, had done something in the scope and breadth of their duties that qualified them not only to be in federal court, removing cases from state court to federal court, but also permitted the federal government to represent them and sometimes even substitute the United States of America for them. And so there are all sorts of remedies that come from that transfer. Here we have five of these named defendants, including, that's right, Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff, one of the principal defendants in this Georgia case. We know about him as well. Again, the former chief of staff for the former president, a lot in the news these days. He is charged with one violation of the RICO Act and one count of solicitation of violation of oath by a public officer. Again, during a visit to Georgia, according to the indictment, he showed up at a vote counting facility, was not permitted entry. The authorities there said, nope, even though you're the chief of staff, can't come in. But he put Donald Trump on the phone with a top state election investigator in an attempt to get entry into that facility at the time, and presumably to have an impact upon the voting and the counting that was taking place there. Those are some of the violations charged against him. Mark Meadows and four others, including at least one of the fake electors, we'll get to her in just a moment, have sought a federal inclusion, if you will, an umbrella to bring this case into the federal court, bringing it from state court into the trappings of a federal district court there in Georgia. And so on Monday, mark your calendars for Monday, because on Monday, a federal judge in Georgia is going to entertain this argument offered principally by Mark Meadows, but also joined in by other defendants, to ask that this case, at least the portion of the case as to them, be removed from the state court into the federal court. What is the prediction on this? Highly, highly unlikely that a federal district court judge who does this routinely, who looks at these kinds of things civilly and, yes, sometimes criminally, and determines whether or not particular federal officers, number one, are federal officers at the time of the conduct, and second, if even if they are, Is their conduct of the sort that is in the ambit of their actual duties and responsibilities, as I indicated already, got to do those thresholds, got to make those findings before you can transfer a case in. Highly.
The kids are heading back to class, but when the subject is school, we have to talk about the first kindergarten started in Wisconsin. Marguerite Schurz created what is known as America's First Kindergarten in 1856, teaching a small class at her family's home in Watertown. It's about 50 miles west-northwest of Milwaukee. So can you guess, when did kindergarten become part of the state's public school system? The answer coming up. Schurz learned about kindergarten in Germany, where the idea was common. It wasn't in America, and her class grew so quickly, she had to move to a bigger space. Today, the building remains as a Watertown museum. So did you guess when kindergarten became part of the public school system in the state? It was 1898, but 42 years prior, the Schurz School started it all, making this a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
And apparently, Maggie Dawn, Fig Newton lover of the Maggie Dawn Show.
I was so offended, Jane. You know how much I love and admire you. You're like my freaking radio hero. And then to hear you bash my Newton.
It's still bad.
You want the cakey part cakey. You want the jammy part jammy. That is like bringing me back.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw. High of 71 this afternoon, under overcast skies, northeasterly winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. Partly cloudy tonight, lows level off around 58. 73 tomorrow, bright sunshine. Mainly clear skies Monday, with daytime highs approaching 78. 76, chance for scattered rain showers Tuesday. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 64 degrees.
Your home of the Earl Ingram Show. Weekday mornings from 8 till 10 on The Shaw. 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK.
Welcome back to this, our last segment in this first hour of Morning Cannolis. And we're talking about the Georgia indictments against 19 defendants, including the former president, including at least two, three, four, five of those defendants who are seeking to remove their cases from the state court into federal court. And yes, indeed, Ross, one of our great listeners, has sent a text to us asking that we comment about the circumstances under which this can happen. And that's what we're doing right now. Ross, thanks so much for your inquiry, your comment sent to us. Here at the studios by text. We appreciate your invitation to have this important discussion. Let's take up Ross's inquiry and pursue this a bit further. We know that in addition to the lawyers indicted, including Cheesebrough and Powell, those who are, again, seeking this immediate trial coming up in October, and these five others now seeking to have the case transferred from state court to federal court, different kinds of things going on here, that among those five is one of these so-called fake electors. And we know that those fake electors identified by name specifically in this particular indictment. One of them is Kathy Latham. Another one is David Schaefer. Another one is Sean Still. All of them, all those three, identified as people who knowingly and purposely engaged, number one, in a violation of the RICO Act there, but also engaged in this conspiracy to commit election fraud, forgery in the first degree, false statements, criminal attempt to commit the filing of false documents, computer theft, computer trespass to defraud the state of Georgia. All of that alleged against these fake electors brought into, again, the state system there. Very similar to the way that the AG, the Attorney General in the state of Michigan, another state prosecution, has likewise brought charges against the fake electors in that state. Here in Georgia, however, Kathy Latham, among those asking that her case, she's among the five, be removed from the state court into federal court. And significantly, this push for the removal of the case, the movement into a federal court, premised upon her view, that even though she wasn't a federal employee, that she was acting at the behest, the encouragement of a federal employee, presumably Donald Trump. She's saying that she also gets the protection of this particular statute, by virtue of the fact that she was doing this on behalf of the federal authorities who are telling her to do this, whether it's the chief of staff, the president, others, presumably co-defendants, also telling her that this is something that they should do, that she says she possesses a right to have this case removed as an officer of the United States or a person acting under officers of the United States. I would offer to her and presumably to the federal judge is going to be looking at this. This is an extraordinarily broad interpretation. She is alleging that she is not an employee, but by virtue of the fact that she was told to do this by others, she's effectively deputized, if you will, in the federal system. The law, of course, permits, as I've indicated, a federal judge to take a look at these circumstances and determine whether the circumstances are such to believe this person was acting, again, as a federal employee in the scope and duties of their responsibility. Something that, again, I don't think any of those defendants will be able to show. But secondarily here, you've got a non-federal employee who's also seeking the protection of the federal law to get into state court. We will see. We will see what happens on Monday. And again, mark your calendars for one of two hearings Monday in the courts of America having to do with the disposition of these cases. Federal judge looking at this. Fascinating to see on Monday what the evidence will be presented by Mark Meadows, arguably these others, maybe including this particular false elector. What is the basis for asking for the removal of this? You have allegedly committed a state crime, and you are now seeking not only the protection of federal law, but you're maintaining that you did this in the scope and duties of your responsibilities or those assigned to you by people who are federal authorities. It is, at a minimum, a huge stretch. Prediction here that the federal judge will entertain the arguments. Will be interesting to see what kind of evidence is presented by these defendants. If they want to take the stand, they certainly can. They can testify on their own behalf. But when you're on the stand, you're also subject to what's called cross-examination, which means if they take the stand, whether it's Mark Meadows or Kathy Latham or anyone else who's there on Monday or future hearings, have also got to be subject to cross-examination by whom? By the prosecutors, who will certainly ask them about the circumstances under which they did this. Why? Hugely relevant, right, to a question of whether or not their particular conduct is covered by this federal statute that permits removal when, again, the circumstances are such to establish your duties and responsibilities, you're executing those as a way of getting these cases into federal court. Again, a stretch. We will see what the evidence says. We will see who testifies, who doesn't. And I would suspect by Monday or shortly thereafter, we'll know whether this skirmish off to the side, again, that the prosecutors in the state of Georgia have got to attend to, undeniably, is shut down as it probably should be routinely. And so we'll talk more about that down the road as well. We know as well that there's a second important hearing coming up on Monday, and it's also a reason to mark your calendar even while you're at work doing other things with your family. Take note of this on your news feeds, and that is in the federal case. Again, this is the federal case, not the Georgia case. The federal case in which Donald Trump, singular defendant, has been charged with these four counts, also alleging violations of the federal law there. And Judge Chutkan, Tanya Chutkan, is having a hearing, and another important hearing on Monday. And what is the purpose of the hearing? It's called a pretrial conference. You get the parties together. In this case, it will not be the cast of 19 in Georgia. That's a different case. Those are different circumstances there. It's one defendant. It's Donald Trump and his lawyers, and it is the prosecutor, the federal prosecutor. It's Jack Smith, special counsel, and his colleagues in front of Judge Chutkan. And at that time, why are we anticipating this hearing with great anticipation? We're anticipating it because Judge Chutkan has announced that she is going to be taking under consideration and presumably announcing on Monday when the trial in that case, the federal case, will happen. We know that Donald Trump, through his attorneys, has asked for a trial in, yes, that's right, 2026. Highly unlikely that Judge Chutkan will do anything even approaching that. Jack Smith has offered January 2nd of, yes, 2024. 2024. Unlikely that is the date either. Sometime perhaps in 2024, if everything falls into place properly, she may be able to accomplish this trial, recognizing that she's got to find the time to do this, even with one defendant. Even the scope of this jury selection presumably is going to take days, if not weeks. Opening statements, presentation by many, many witnesses. This trial alone will probably be weeks, if not months in duration. Got to find the time for that. She can plainly find that there is excludable time in what's called the Speedy Trial Act to schedule this as she will. And she has said to Donald Trump and to the attorneys involved in all of this that indeed she will move this case along expeditiously. Lots of things have got to happen in the coming months, including motions to dismiss, motions to suppress, all kinds of pretrial proceedings. But we will look to Judge Chutkan on Monday to determine what she does in the midst of all of this. And when we come back at the top of our second hour, we're going to take some of your phone calls about this and more, and then we're going to move into other matters related to these indictments here on Morning Cannolis. Stay with us in our second hour as we discuss the rule of law, justice, and government in this nation of ours.
So, darling, save the last dance for me. Oh, baby, won't you save the last dance for me? Ooh, you make a promise that you'll save the last dance for me.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
You are never far away from your favorite local radio station. We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app, and we invite you to get social with us by following our network's Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook pages. Want even more? CivicMedia.us.
You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha.